Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this Free CP number 111. Well, this will be my last podcast of 2024, so I thought I'd kick off the new year with an episode that certainly helped me to see my own path forwards in life for the next year coming. My guest, Alex Martinoff, is a leadership coach who I ended up speaking to quite by chance in Prague this year during our annual conference. He was a last-minute booking who agreed to fill in for Mikkel Thorup after his flight to Prague was delayed long enough to miss his interview slot. Actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise for me, as you will hear. To cut a long story short, my conversation with Alex turned into an impromptu coaching session that subsequently resulted in me making a very important life decision, namely to go all in on this podcast and choose to pursue it as a full-time job rather than the part-time endeavour that it was at the time. Anyway, hopefully through our candid conversation, you may also find some insights into your own situation as you begin this new year. To be honest, prior to this experience, I would have said that I was pretty good at knowing what it is that I want and getting it. But as you will hear, I wasn't necessarily completely in touch with the source of my intentions, and I'm very grateful to Alex for putting up a mirror to me during our discussion. I've just let an AI dissect the conversation, so here's what it came up with. It says Timothy engages in a compelling discussion with Alex, a self-leadership coach, exploring the interplay between inner freedom and external constraints. They examine how internal dialogues can either liberate or limit us, emphasizing self-awareness, psychological understanding, and mindfulness in connecting with our true selves. Topics discussed include societal influences on personal values, balancing logic with intuition, self-authoring beliefs beyond social norms, and navigating career transitions authentically. Well, that's the AI perspective. From my perspective, though, I would say there was a very pivotal moment in this conversation, and that was when Alex asked me the very simple question, what do you want? And after listening to our back and forth, I would advise you to ask yourself the same question. I've had many conversations since this one, and it's very surprising how many people answer that same question with a watered-down version of the truth, as I did initially. Anyway, I think this is a perfect episode to start the new year with, and whilst every sunrise is certainly an opportunity to start again, there will be an even bigger opportunity, in my opinion, in committing to new resolutions as 2025 kicks off in a few days. And I wish you all the best for this new year coming. A bit of housekeeping before I go. I will start up the Nostra comments again next week once I get back to recording these intros, just before the episode goes out. And in the meantime, of course, and for the last time in 2024, I hope you can find a peaceful place to sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Alex Martinoff. Kindly agreed to fill in for someone else who just dropped out. And as a result, I've done zero research on you. Mm. Well, I haven't done zero research, actually. I just did about 5 minutes research because you came down at a very short notice, about 20 minutes ago that I called you. Yeah. And as a result, and actually this is not a bad thing because I love going into interviews with no knowledge at all. So from my sort of 2 minutes of research, I understand you're a life coach, which is already interesting. And when I went Googled you, the first two things that came up that you were talking about were complexity anti-patterns and T groups, right? Which I don't know what either of those are. So I'm already intrigued. Anyway, you're actually giving a speech here at Liberty in Our Lifetime, and I think that's a good starting point because the name of the title of your speech is Liberty Inside of Us. And I'm going to go ahead and sort of hypothesize that as a life coach, you've got a lot of good ways to sort of help people to find true liberty. And am I on the right track?
Yes. The only thing I would probably not position myself as life coach, even though kind of, it's life work and professional stuff. So usually I call myself leadership coach.
Ah, okay.
And a bit cheesier, I added self-leadership coach recently because related to this talk, a lot of things that we do internally tends to create either liberty or more kind of restrictions and oppressions within us. And when this happens, usually it reflects in how we behave externally. So kind of there is kind of this division between inner realm and outer realm, but they are interconnected as well.
Sorry, I wasn't following exactly what you said then. Yeah. Did you say when people do work, inner work on themselves, they often end up creating more obstacles, did you say?
No, it's actually an interesting thing, and that's what I want to highlight in my talk, is that a lot of things that we do unwittingly inside creates more oppression or more tension or more restriction. And often that's the case, at least what I notice among libertarians, is that a lot of people don't pay that much attention to psychology. And one of the rationale I see for that is because kind of many read Mises, and Mises said, well, that's basically the scope of economics, and these are the things that psychology deals with. And I think a lot of people made a wrong conclusion about that, is like, psychology doesn't matter. We just need to learn economics and praxeology, and that's enough. I don't think that's necessarily what he meant. And I think because of that, a lot of people don't pay that much attention to what's happening inside, kind of how our thinking creates the internal processes.
Can you give me an example of something that I might unwittingly create mm-hmm. inside myself?
Yeah. Imagine you want to get thinner, and you also want to eat a pizza. So usually there is kind of a conflict between parts. And what we unwittingly do is that we side with one part. So basically we ignore a proper need to I don't know, help us with comfort food or whatever. So when we ignore those needs, usually we suppress them for some time, but then they grab control, they hijack the control. And usually it's like a seesaw, because like one part swing, then the other takes control. And in order to have more liberty, we need to pay more attention to, and that's what I will also bring in the talk, is that cognitive scientist Marvin Minsky, he called it society of the mind. And in our society of the mind, there are many agents which basically make sure that all the needs that we have as an organism are satisfied. And when we ignore them, bad things are happening.
Okay, using your example of pizza and wanting to lose weight, because I can totally sort of relate to that. And I can also totally relate to the cycle that I go through of getting a little bit overweight, which I am currently, and then abstaining from food, getting back down, and then just creeping back up again. So I'm obviously ignoring my need for comfort food or for whatever reason. So how should I do that then, just out of interest?
You listen to this need and you acknowledge it. And I think what's erroneously a lot of people assume is that acknowledging and giving empathy means agreeing. And it's not necessarily the case. You know, like if a baby cries, you don't say, don't cry. You just, oh, you're probably sad. And they just need acknowledging and then they can process this thing. So potentially what works and what I notice working is that we need to acknowledge all of those things inside of us. Like if you take workaholic, they just work, and they don't pay attention to what's happening inside of them. And at a certain point, I don't know, I hope not a heart attack, but usually there's some kind of wake-up call.
So in the
then they realize that a lot of things were happening they didn't pay attention to.
In my pizza example, are you suggesting then that the reason I want comfort food is much deeper than just
I need to eat.
And that's what I'm missing.
Yeah.
How would I access that then, for example, according to you?
It's almost like a conversation. So you just have a conversation. You kind of slow down, you pay attention to what's going on, and you start a conversation with this part. And more often than not, that's the case. Like my work mostly interpersonal. So I help people improve their leadership skills, communication skills. So a lot of things that I do, it's mostly interpersonally. But the same things work intrapersonally as well. So for example, in the realm of negotiation, very simple thing, the distinction between position and interest. So whenever we're stuck in the negotiation, usually it's because we're stuck on the level of the position. And position is like a solution to a problem. So I have a problem, and that's the solution that I envision, and I push for that. But when we kind of broaden our view and we think about the interest, we can think, okay, maybe there are different solutions for that. And for example, like pizza example, it could be about, I don't know, maybe pizza is associated with community. You eat pizza with friends, and you really want kind of belonging rather than just a comfort food. And that's kind of the thing about smoking and drinking. I don't work with these kind of things, but usually like smoking is about like smoking with people and having break, having rest. So there's some kind of a intention behind it, and some kind of behavior is stuck with this intention. But when we explore the intention, we then can negotiate with this part and find a better way to satisfy this need that we have. But need is often legitimate.
In my case, I am a former smoker many years ago now. But I noticed that what I loved about smoking was that it allowed me to give myself permission to have some free time.
Yes.
It's a really weird thing because it was like a 4 or 5 minute cigarette. And I knew when I was taking that cigarette, I could sit back and just do that and not do the thing I was doing.
Freedom.
It was a version of that. Yes. Exactly. And actually what got me off cigarettes in the end, I realized that you can't give up smoking unless you want to. And that's going to sound a bit strange.
Yeah.
It seems a bit obvious. And it is obvious. But when you're a smoker, it's not that obvious. You need a reason to give up. And in my case, my wife's father died of cancer and she gave up. And then all of a sudden, there was no one to smoke with either. So there, you know, and I just kind of stopped smoking. And looking back now in hindsight, it's a crazy thing to think about smoking when you're in that world of cigarettes do this. I read a really good book, actually. You probably know it. It was Alan Carr's book. Yeah. And because everyone said, if you read that book, you'll give up smoking. And I thought, nah, you know, like I'm not going to read a book and give up smoking. I quite enjoy smoking. You know, I did read it and I don't even remember it affecting me. But the thing that he pointed out that was really remarkable was that you think you get something from smoking. Most people think you have a cigarette and you get something. It relaxes you, it sustains you, it does whatever. But actually, that's not true. What smoking does is it takes something away from you in the beginning and then it just replaces it each time. So prior to you ever smoking, you were absolutely full and fine. But what smoking did is it sort of created this void in which you have to fill with smoking because it's the addiction to the nicotine, which wasn't there before. And that must have really worked on my subconscious because I started realizing every time I took a cigarette now, I thought, I'm not getting anything from this. So why am I doing it? You know, it was interesting. But I like the way you attach it to notions of freedom. I've never thought of it like that. For me, it was just a break from life, having a cigarette, you know. But you're right, it is. It was like being free from the obligation to do whatever it was I was doing. Tell me about some other things that I probably don't know are to do with freedom then.
Well, one of the things is that we are complex in our nature. And a lot of things we disown, basically by means of upbringing, because certain things were supported by parents and important adults, and certain were not. So we kind of stuff them. And like Jung, probably a lot of people know about it. Like he talks about the shadow, the stuff that is disowned. And I think freedom is to start to own it back. So basically go to the closet and start taking people. It's not going to be something I will talk about in a few days, but I think freedom is about acknowledging everything that is there and being able to be with it rather than being able to be possessed by it. Because often this stuff from the closet, it takes control when we kind of least expect it. It kind of hijacks us. So many people have the situations where kind of I did something and then I thought back, well, I shouldn't have done it. Like it was as if it wasn't me, like something in me did that. And it's usually because like we suppress it, but like when we push it, it pushes back. It just accumulates the power and then takes control. I think also what's important kind of for liberty, for freedom inside is to understand who we are and what we want. And it's a natural, unfortunate, but natural process of how socialization happens right now, basically through schooling. And what happens is, of course, kids have impulses. They need to learn to deal with them. And they first need to learn how to internalize the needs of others. So they're just not doing whatever they want. But the bad outcome of that is that at a certain point, they don't know what they want. They just have voices of teachers, whatever, politicians saying them what's right and what's wrong. So basically people lose touch with their own value system. And this is like a sad thing. And like I'm 40 and I work with a lot of people, same kind of age group. So late 30s, 40s, kind of this midlife crisis type of population demographics. And I talk to those people as coach and like you ask them what they want. I don't know. They have like elaborate system of algorithms, like if I want money, I know how to gain them, but like, do I want them? Well, society tells me that I need them or I should need them, but like nothing in their heart says that they really want them. So they lose touch with who they are. So some kind of work that can help people to get in touch with who they are, what they want. And body is a good indicator of that because body tells us what it wants. Sometimes in distorted way, but at least when we start acknowledge it and we can ask it questions like, what do you mean by that? Because sometimes people eat not because they want to eat, but because they are sad or lonely.
You reminded me of something. Presumably you've read Harry Brown's book.
Yes.
I was going to say, because yes. You were describing a morality trap there. I think that's what he calls a morality trap, which is kind of, you've built up this morality based on other people's moralities.
Yes.
And before you know it, you can't think for yourself. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes. And like part of the things that I want to bring up is that a lot of the things that we know from the libertarian literature, economics, basically a lot of thinkers, not everybody, but a lot of thinkers in the field of psychology, they think about somewhat similar things, but maybe from a different perspective. And for example, Robert Keegan, who's a prominent developmental psychologist, he talks about these stages of development. So first he calls this imperial mind, when kind of people are impulsive, basically egocentric. Like kids at certain age, they even are not able to have this theory of mind, which is basically understanding that people have different stuff in their heads. So they think, okay, I was in the room, therefore, even if mommy was not in the room, she knows what happened in the room because, like, of course she knows. She has this similar stuff inside of her head. The next stage is socialized mind, basically indoctrination. I'm guessing it's going to be different for kids who are unschooled or homeschooled because the whole premise is to help them develop their natural inclinations. But usually, I was schooled, of course, we are indoctrinated with these programs, moral things, beliefs which are not ours. In psychology, they call it about introjection. So stuff is introjected in your head and it lives there. And the next stage is self-authoring, self-authoring mind. So basically, you can create your own beliefs based on what you value, what is yours inherently.
And presumably, everyone pulls different versions of that into their sort of adult life. Different, yes. Different intensities of those things.
Yes.
Because I notice, I hate to say it, but I know a couple of people who, when you were describing that first stage where a baby doesn't even understand that the mother is not thinking the same thing as them, I know a couple of adults who aren't that bad, but they really don't understand that what they're experiencing could be completely different to what someone else is experiencing. And it comes across as quite self-centered. In a way, it is self-centered, isn't it?
Yeah.
They have no idea that actually their view of the world is not universal. And I like the way you've described it there.
Just a quick thing. And for people like this, the empathy is difficult because they think they need to kind of leave their position. Or they need to forsake their views in order to understand others. And that's the big misconception. Kind of, if I'm going to listen to someone, it means that I agree with them, which is not the case. And the development then follows the pattern that kind of I hold my stand, I hold my ground, but I also listen and mentally in my kind of mental headspace, I'm capable of having two positions at the same time, not agreeing, not siding with either one, but just having them almost as a picture. I can see both before doing anything about them.
I mean, that's quite a common experience in the modern world. In particular, I mean, you know, in talking about people who won't debate a particular subject, there's a lot of political people out there at the moment who don't like debating.
Yes.
Is that why? Because they feel that if they debate this other person, it means they're agreeing with them, isn't it?
Yes. I think like one of the biggest traps is righteousness, which is being aggressive about being right. And this usually is an urge that kicks in automatically. And it's hard to be with it. And like we all have certain kind of triggers, like certain things we can be with, and certain things we cannot be with. They just consume us totally. We cannot be with something without kind of being separate from it. And probably that also has to do with the way we are educated. I think a lot about schooling and how it distorts our mental capacities. Because we are in the school, we are in a very linear world where certain things are true and certain things are not true. There are right answers that we need to give to teachers, and there are wrong answers. And obviously life is more complicated. There are different shadows of gray, but like we for 10 years, for a dozen of years, we're told to be in a black and white world, and then it becomes more difficult to kind of hold on uncertainty of how complex is the world. And then, of course, we want to closure. We want to have a closure. We need to have a simple answer that will align and makes us calm and assured that everything is right. We are good people, they are bad people, everything is all right.
I've noticed recently, and by that I mean in the last few years, that the whole world appears to have become far more politicized. People care about their opinion, their political opinion, and they're much more than they ever used to. I don't ever recall being young and arguing over anything political.
Mm.
I mean, I wouldn't say I argue over things political now, but I like to discuss them because people want to, and there's a lot of rigid minds who've decided on a political idea.
Mm.
Why do you think that is? Like, why is it that recently it appears to be the thing that everyone wants to get involved in? Because I don't recall, I think one way of thinking about it is I don't recall everyone being so opinionated historically. Yeah. Is that right or wrong? Am I missing something?
I read something, I don't remember the book, but it's about human connection. And it was written, which is not very common, by a conservative author. And I think one of the points he makes is that it has to do with belonging and loneliness, because belonging to a political tribe is a release of this need. When we adhere to kind of the right set of ideas, we feel like we are on the good side of history. We are with the good people. We are part of the tribe. And I think maybe it has to do with that. Is that like there is a, maybe it has also to do with the digitalization of the world, and people feel more stranded and lonely. And this thing being kind of part on the right side of culture wars, it's kind of gives people some kind of release of this need.
I suppose you're right. The there are far less community feelings in the world as there were 50 or 100 years ago. Similarly, I suppose that religious feelings are probably in the UK certainly are less. They're all part of belonging, aren't they? And I'd never thought of it like that. One of the things that when you talk about freedom inside, when people talk about freedom, my first thought is physical freedom. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to negotiate physical freedom sometimes. Yeah. And when that happens, my secondary thought is always, right, the way to deal with this then is inner freedom. Is that a correct thought process? Because take, for example, like I really don't like being told what to do. Sometimes you kind of have to accept it. If you're standing in front of a very irrational, large man and he wants to fight you, you can stay and fight if you want, but you can probably also think, do you know what? It's better if I go. Mm. And in that sense, or take it a little bit more extreme, I've been imprisoned by someone like that in a cage. I've got no option to be free physically, right? Yeah. Is that the time then when you go inside and go, okay, how do I create freedom here? Uh-huh. I mean, sorry if it's too extreme, but I've thought about freedom for a long time.
Yeah.
And this is the one, this is the bug, this is the fly in the ointment, mm-hmm. is when someone physically overpowers you and you lose your freedom.
It's an interesting question, and I think it's also related to not only psychology but spirituality as well. And like many spiritual traditions will frame self-development as liberation. Like Buddhism is about that, is about releasing the attachment. What may be relevant here is the work of Viktor Frankl, who was a psychologist in a Nazi concentration camp. And basically that was the last frontier which he was able to control. Obviously, there was no choice for them. He was not able to walk away from this bully. He was basically entrapped. But he was entrapped externally, and there were different choices that from there he could have made, different mental strategies. And he maintained the inner freedom or capacity for being free inside of them when he was free, captured kind of physically. Obviously, that's a too kind of extreme example. But I think the more we develop this capacity to be with unfreedom internally, I mean, being with external unfreedom internally, the easiest it's going to be for us. For example, let's say this person makes a promise of violence, and whatever you do is going to be in reaction to that. So even if you fight back, it's going to be slightly unfree because you are not choosing your way. You are acting on his action. The kind of example that I make often is like, imagine like your parents want you to go to the medical school. So you can rebel and say, no way, I'll not go study there. That's also, it's not freedom, it's reaction to their expectation. So sometimes the interesting thing about the internal work is, okay, so there's this decision I need to make, either or. But then, can I step back and see what's important for me? Can I consider other options? Because more often than not, when there's invitation or there's violent action like this, we feel constrained, and there is this kind of dichotomy. Either I accept it or I fight back. But what's there?
So in the case of the guy that's sizing up to me, ready to attack me, mm-hmm. and he's obviously bigger than me, so I know that the chances are I'll lose this battle. The freedom is in the fact that I'm making a conscious decision, not just reacting to him.
Yes.
I'm standing here saying, I'm confronted with this obstacle.
Yes.
I have the option to leave, and that's fine, or the option to stay and fight. The option to stay and fight puts me into a situation I don't want to be in, so I'll just leave. That's my freedom. Is that right?
In a way, yeah.
How do I separate that, though, from the fact that the only reason I'm making that decision is because this guy's threatening me?
Well, one way, or kind of one idea that can help to ease into this way of behaving, is that we are not in control of what's happening. So what I'm saying is that reality is fundamentally unpredictable. So there's no way we can have it our way. At the end of the day, we are going to die. So kind of we need to surrender and accept our lack of fundamental control. Obviously, to a degree, we have control. But fundamentally, on a bus stop, something fell on a man and he died in Prague recently. Something like this can happen. No insurance will help you. Nothing will help you. So it can sound daunting, but more often than not, that's the release. Okay, I'm not in control. So how can I live my life in accordance to who I am on the intersection between what I want and what reality is offering to me?
And the fact that we're out of control, and that sounds a bit negative, but you know what I mean. We're not in control.
Yes.
I take it that the reason we want to be in control is because chaos makes us uneasy or nervous. We're, part of the human spirit is wanting to know what's going to happen.
That, and also that we associate ourselves with the ego, which is basically like an internal manager. But we are more spacious than that, so ego is obviously there, and it does an important job, but it's not the wholeness of us. So kind of when we can consider that there are different things, and like we are having this conversation as an improvisation. And in music, some people can improvise, and some people can only read notes, and they will be very tense if they need to improvise. And in a way, it's just a skill. Like, how can you go with the flow? How can you trust the kind of the flow of life as it happening, as it unfolds? And trusting this unfolding is like partially, I think it's most of the spiritual traditions talk about something like this, trust in something bigger than myself.
Yes. Now, here's where I suppose my own personal spirituality might come a little bit unstuck, I suppose. Uh-huh. I'm a big advocate of letting go, and I love living life on the hoof. I don't like making plans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like addressing every moment as a fresh moment and then responding accordingly, you know. But as far as something bigger than myself, that one I've never really managed to experience. The notion that there's something bigger than me,
it's semantic, because that's only one way to frame it. Another way to frame it is like basically I was given I have this body. So this is the only thing that I have, the only thing that is ultimately mine. And if I revere this body or this organism, if I revere the mystery of who I am and serve it, that's something bigger than me already, because like I did not create this body. I inhabit it, I have it, and it's the vehicle through which I can live, which is also a mystery. Like, how can I live? What's life at all? What's consciousness? Like, scientists cannot answer this properly. So even that is a mystery. Even that is something bigger than us. But we can look at life more routinely, kind of as a set of tasks to do, societal or whatever, or work tasks. But I think like Heidegger talks about mindfulness of being or forgetfulness of being, and a lot of times people forget that they are being, they exist. They're not just like driving to work, driving from work, or whatever they do. It's not like a set a string of tasks to do in their life. Like there is this mystery of being, sometimes predictable, sometimes unpredictable, but that's already something bigger than us. We don't need necessarily to agree with something which is kind of a mysterious God or universe. It's just like physical fact as well, that there is something bigger than us. There is a mystery in us that we are not capable to solve. And I'm guessing that we are not inherently capable of solving. It's not about like having more research or having bigger computers that will calculate every neuron and how it operates. It's more about like the brain cannot hold itself.
I agree with you on the mindfulness, and something I suppose grapple is one way of describing it. I grapple with, because, and for me, mindfulness exists as awareness and yes. non-awareness. And when I'm not aware, I'm normally fully in my head, carrying out tasks, doing the things I think I'm supposed to do,
yeah.
you know. But interestingly for me, when I find myself sort of falling back into my awareness, that's when I feel like I'm me,
yes.
actually. But what you were alluding to then was that the state of mindfulness is actually bigger than you. But I actually feel that's actually the me that I feel, because I don't actually, to be honest, when I'm thinking and doing a lot of the time and I'm not aware of the mm-hmm. fact that mm-hmm. I'm doing it, that's like a computer program just running on autopilot.
Yeah.
So am I thinking, is this a different experience, my experience of mindfulness?
No, it's very typical. And like there's philosopher and psychiatrist Ian McGilchrist, and he wrote this amazing book, King and Its Emissary. And basically it's about different ways of being. Metaphorically, he refers to them, even though it's not like super distinct, but kind of left brain thinking and right brain thinking, which one is more rational, analytical, where you basically split everything in parts. It's kind of mechanical way of relating to the world. And another is more holistic. And what's interesting about the left way of being is that usually it's easier to stuck there. So when we're in this mode of being, we forget that there is a different one, a broader one. And the metaphor is that like the king sends his emissary, and emissary proclaims himself as a king and kind of rebels against the king. And that's kind of his metaphor of what should our rational minds be doing. They should serve us, but they become like the ruler. So they grab the power, and it's easier for them to grab the power just from the way the brain is wired.
Can you talk a little bit about then the difference between sort of making logical decisions
mm-hmm.
and making what I suppose a lot of people would call intuitive decisions, or I would call those kind of decisions they arise from the mindfulness place.
Yeah.
And certainly there are absolutely times when you should be making a logical decision.
Yes.
I think that's very important. But I think the problem that many people sort of succumb to is that they always make logical decisions. And that may not be the best strategy. Not in my yes. experience, anyway. I've spent half my life probably making logical decisions, and the other half just flowing down a river, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's like.
Yes.
And every now and then, you know, my logical mind goes, oh, there's a bend coming up. Maybe I should sort of edge myself towards here. But the most of the time, I'm just flowing down the river, you know.
Yeah. Well, actually, I had a coaching conversation this week, and like the client is a brilliant person, like has PhD, he's very smart. But when I was talking to him, I noticed like something is lacking. And then when we explore, it seems like there are great algorithms to create decisions, but there is no input data. Like nothing comes from his heart. And you know, you can have the greatest mechanisms to make decisions, the greatest mental models, but like what will you feed into it? if you don't have any intentions, any values, any desires, like what will go there? Like based on what you're going to make those brilliant decisions. And for him, it was a revelation because like, yes, I can make a decision, but it comes from nowhere. Like it basically like feeds into itself. You know, it's like aqueduct without the access to water. It's kind of like nothing is there. So obviously we need to use both systems because they are very important. Otherwise, evolutionary, they will not be there. But what often happens is that sometimes the rational mind, it thinks that it's right. And it almost like has this promise of just follow what I'm saying to you and you would be happy. But the thing is, like, happiness cannot come from thinking or like from the rational analytical thinking. Happiness comes from emotions or from the body or from heart metaphorically. So if you don't have access to that kind of energy, I'm not saying it in the new age, but like this type of thinking or cognitive processes, emotional, then the decision making, the rational decision making, it just cannot do its work. It works perfectly when you give him a passionate idea or passionate goal, then you can use those algorithms and mechanisms to make decisions. But when you just stuck in thinking for the sake of thinking, then it lacks something. It becomes bland.
How did you trigger him then or her to to tap into that?
Yeah.
Input. So,
what usually happens when like this? I give you like this particular example. So I asked him a question, like a simple question. What do you want in this session? And I noticed like for a millisecond he was stuck and then started saying something.
Can I just ask you a question? Do we know why he was even in the session to start
yes,
with?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so did he have a reason that he understood to come to the session?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
right.
Yeah.
Because that would be my starting point. Yeah. I was like, why are you even here? Like,
yeah. But that's also the point. Like sometimes people come and they kind of don't need anything, and that's also a surprise.
But why are they coming then now of interest?
Because this thing is like a yearning. Even if you are not connected to it rationally, there is a yearning, that there is like a knowing voice, like something is lacking. But some people are willing to explore that or to act on that. Some will just will try to stuff it down even deeper down. But with this particular person, what we did is kind of, he started answering something which didn't make any sense because like I can hear those things because like of a training. And I just interrupted him and like I said, can we do an experiment? I'll ask you the same question and you don't answer it. Just observe what's happening when you hear the question. So I asked the same question. And then he developed a bit more awareness of how he goes about answering this type of question. And he noticed his stuckness and his incapacity of answering this type of question, which for him was a bit of a kind of a revelation, because like he didn't understand that he lacks this capacity. And then he was more present to it. And in a way, coaching is about developing this kind of self-awareness, like thinking about how we think. A very simplistic definition. So then he noticed, okay, I noticed that this is happening. And he's quite smart and he's quite capable once he realized that to do something about it.
Hmm. It's funny because you're reminding me of, I've never actually been to see someone like you, a coach or a life coach. But when you talked about that yearning, that sort of feeling that something wasn't quite right or that something was missing, I've definitely had that. But thinking back now, I dealt with it in rather an interesting way. And I don't know whether you would advocate for this. You probably wouldn't. But I used to work at a newspaper in London. I was there for like 7 years. Mm. I was the chief photographer and it was all good. Everyone thought I was doing my dream job. But I had this sort of niggly feeling that this wasn't what I was supposed to be doing, kind of thing. But I couldn't get to the bottom of it. I didn't really know what to do. Back then, I had access to hallucinogenic drugs. In particular, I had a house out in the countryside, and every October, these magic mushrooms used to grow all over my land. Okay, uh-huh. And I've known from experience that they do help you to get in touch with sort of deeper parts of yourself. So I, one weekend, I went up to my, I had this cottage out in right in the middle of Wales, in the middle of nowhere, with the strict intention to find out why was, on one hand, I'm in this dream job, doing my dream job. I'm at the top, I'm riding a wave. But on the other hand, there's something that doesn't feel quite right. So I went up there on my own one night, brewed up some tea, some like mushroom tea, not a really strong one, just enough to sort of let the doors of perception open up a little bit, because I knew there was something going on there. And I think probably nowadays I'd probably go to someone like yourself to find this out. But I had a really incredible experience that completely changed my life.
Yeah,
it wasn't even a really intense experience. So I had this intention, right? Just show me what I'm missing here. Yeah. And at some point in the night, and if you've ever taken hallucinogens, you'll understand the way I'm describing this is kind of, you have to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. But I experienced my life as a lake. And so I was that lake. My life, my whole life was this lake. And in the middle of this lake, there was a sword in the lake. Do you know, like the lady in the lake pulling the sword out, the kind of thing. But this sword was like pointed straight downwards in this lake. And I knew that that was my apartment in London, even though it was a sword. This was my apartment. And it wasn't even symbolic. It was, you know, that it was my apartment. And because I had this gorgeous apartment in London, and it was my dream apartment that I bought in an old, it was in an old abattoir actually, but it was, you know, it was a really cool apartment. Everyone loved there. We used to come back there and stuff. And in that experience, this massive hand came in, pulled out the sword from this lake. And as it did, it sent ripples out, concentric rings of ripples outwards, which affected every part of my life, because the lake was my life. And I experienced the way that removing the apartment created all this change throughout my whole life, right? Anyway, after that weekend, I went back to London and I put my apartment on the market to sell, and it sold quite quickly. And within sort of 3 or 4 months, I'd quit my job.
Yeah,
I'd left my girlfriend at the time. I had like sold my apartment, and I was on a one-way, I had a one-way ticket out to the Himalayas. I was just going on this mad mission. But it was the most pivotal point in my life now when I look back. If I look back at the history of you know, my life, there was this absolute U-turn, or not even a U-turn. It was a there was this kind of like, you know, fork in the road there. And I took a very different route. But it was so important that and all I had to do was, obviously my apartment was keeping me there. I hated my life, but I loved I hated my job, but I loved the apartment. And, you know, that was the thing that was keeping me stuck, you know. But yeah, I'm sure nowadays, because I would probably be too scared to take hallucinogens at my age. But nowadays, I could probably talk to a gentleman like yourself and work out that thing, that thing, you know. Do you think it was a genuine experience I had? I mean, it definitely changed my life.
Well, it was, of course. And it's very Jungian kind of story. But also, it reminds me one of the things that people can do as a tool. Because what often happens is this yearning, or these yearnings, they are counterbalanced by things we do to comfort ourselves. Basically, to silence those voices. And one of the practices could be is how to avoid them. So, for example, if someone returns tired from work and then binge watches Netflix, so removing those comforts,
and then it'll show you the discomfort
then
is.
It's kind of to face it more directly without things that it's a Buddhist way of thinking as well, like how can you remove those things that kind of stand in the way of being mindful.
Someone in the kind of freedom community talks about stuckness. Who is it? There's a famous, is it, it's someone like Ayn Rand or someone who talks about, it's not Ayn Rand, but do you know who I mean? Like stuckness.
No, I'm not sure.
Oh, I was talking about it recently. I can't think who it was, but it was a long, that's right. It was when I was talking to Ter de Meester on this podcast. He was talking about stuckness. And he was talking about it in terms of traumas, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, trauma's a broad word these days. but that the stuckness that you feel is an unaddressed trauma. That sounds about like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Something historically which you never acknowledged in yourself, which is now a barrier to you moving forwards.
Yeah. And usually it's also the dynamic between different parts. Like one of the modalities of psychotherapy called internal family systems, which is very efficient in terms of working with PTSD traumas, basically. And it's about addressing the part which has frozen at the time, not being capable of dealing with the shock of the system. So basically it's stuck with this shock. And usually there is something that builds on top of this part, like how can we go on? But this part is there frozen, and most likely there's also going to be critical part which kind of hates this part which is frozen. There's going to be a manager who's going to try to make ends meet and stuff like this. But this dynamic creates the homeostasis, basically the stable structure of this pattern, which needs to find a different way to resolve itself. And usually it's about how this part can release the task that it was not up to at the time, and it doesn't need to deal with it anymore. Like how can it go on?
And the way we acknowledge something like that is when we see the same pattern repeating itself, presumably. Same, like in my case.
Stuckness, procrastination is a very simple, like it's almost like a trauma, like a micro trauma or a small t trauma, like being stuck about, and a lot of things that I do is about being stuck. Like I had session, like 10 minutes, and the lady from Kazakhstan, she has a chain of beauty salons, and she was not able to do the next very thing to develop her business. Something was holding her back, and like she needs to delegate more, and there's something that wants to hold more control. So you know that's basically like a dynamic which there are parts and they are in conflict, and until they are acknowledged, and after the session in half an hour she wrote me, Alex, I did it.
She delegated more. And presumably she felt very uneasy when she was delegating. Is that right? I mean, yeah, because that yeah, would she, be my she experience.
She was stuck about like putting the job offer for administrator, basically to delegate stuff.
Because she didn't want to lose control, or because she didn't want to pay? It was expensive? Or
her story is, I will teach them and they will go away. Why bother?
Right.
But it was a story, of course. It was just a story. And when she acknowledged this part, that kind of, it was hurt of someone leaving earlier, kind of a micro trauma. But it learned that it's not possible to trust those people. So why would I search for new people like that if they will betray me?
I probably should come and see a leadership coach then. You meet me at an interesting point in my life. That sounds like that's a line from the book, isn't it? From the film Fight Club, isn't it? Mm. But Fight Club is a really amazing film with regards to what we're talking about here. Yes. And in fact, I going back to my story of the time when I took mushrooms to sort a problem out, I really understood Fight Club at that point because he had a similar experience at the beginning. I think the way he described it, he was sitting in his apartment surrounded by IKEA furniture that meant nothing. Nothing meant anything. And he was like, what the hell am I doing here? Mine wasn't as intense, but it was still me acknowledging I was sitting in my life and something wasn't quite right, even though everything looked beautiful. You know, it's such a great film, I probably need to do something similar, because I think there's probably a lot of things like what you're talking about there that I don't do for the wrong reasons. Mm. Like delegating tasks is definitely one of them, and in my case, I think it's, according to me at least, it's because there's a part of me that's a perfectionist. And I can't stand the feeling of someone else messing up my thing on behalf of me.
Yeah, and just look at the language. I can't stand it.
Yes.
So you cannot be with it.
Yes, yes. It's a painful experience. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And what we tend to do with these painful experiences, we turn away from them. We either want to avoid them or kind of avoid the situations that can produce those experiences. But what usually happens is when we are with them, just gently, they're not as bad as we predict. So it's like they teach us how to be with them when we are willing to.
I think in the case of, in my case, and I agree that some of it is that, but there's also some of it which is, if I do this thing and I know it'll be a success, then I don't have to deal with all that bullshit. I don't have to deal with someone else's bullshit, you know. That is something that I do, but it's certainly holding me back for sure. Not that I even know what the future should be. I mean, I'm quite happy, obviously, in doing what I do, but I see people like who would, in my situation, would be thinking completely different to me. They would be be evolving, getting more. They would be scaling. They would be doing all these things.
That's one of the things that often is the case. When I start with a client, I ask them what they want. And usually the very typical way of answering this question is first to think about what's possible and choose from that.
Right.
And obviously you're looking like in a tunnel vision like this. And then I interrupt them and say like, but what would you want if anything was possible? So my intention in a way to help them think about the real thing that they want, not the real thing adjusted by what I perceive possible. Because these things which are possible, then we can address them and see, maybe it's not going to be possible, but maybe they're just like limiting beliefs about my possibilities or whatever is possible, or I'm capable only of this. So kind of this dream modality of thinking. How can I allow myself dreaming about just one thing?
Can I butt in a second?
Yes.
Sorry, because I'm going to try and get as much good information about myself now as I can. But I really like what you're saying. And because I was just thinking through my own process as you were speaking. So are you saying that what would be good for someone would be to say to themselves, you know, take away all the factors you think you know about. What would you like? Acknowledge that thing. And then work towards it. Would that be a good strategy? Even if it's kind of like, you know.
So kind of yes, without the last part. So last part may follow or may not follow. What's important is to develop this muscle of thinking bigger and thinking in a connection to the real desires. For example, I offer, it's not like I base my work on tools, but one of the exercises that I often give to people is to write down 100 wishes. And it's very difficult. People get stuck on 20th. Because, and also I invite people to observe what's happening in their heads when they do that. And wishes could be anything, material things, experiences, skills, whatever. It's very hard to write down 100 wishes.
Is it normal to have 100 wishes?
No, it's not, it's not even the purpose of exercise. It's more like a workout. To go and do 100 reps.
So you have to think of 100 things that you want.
Yes.
Does that mean you can't, you're not talking about physical things. You can't say a TV, a car.
Everything,
you can.
Everything, yes.
Right. Yeah.
It's possible to say 100 staples, but.
No, but I mean, I would definitely struggle with that. I mean, it's hard enough at Christmas and birthday time when people say, what do you want? I literally want nothing. You know, that's always my answer. I think long and hard. And apart from actually what I would say is give me something unique, preferably that you made, because that's the only thing I really want, because everything else I can get normally, you know. But sure. I mean, if you said, right, 100 things, I'd start thinking quite big. I mean, I've always wanted a private island, you know, but whether or not I think I'd ever get one. I don't think I want it enough to actually devote my life to getting it, though.
Yeah, and that's kind of the gap between kind of what you describe and the last point that you made. So it depends. So first we kind of map the territory and we work on this muscle of helping people learn to want. And then they can choose, but in a more empowered way. They're not choosing only reactively based on what I kind of based on my trajectory. So I was moving like this, maybe I can add 5% more to that, like 5% salary raise. But that's not the that's not the point. How can we do something qualitatively different? And more often than not, because I work with a lot of people from tech, I'm from tech background, and all of them are very smart. And very smart in the head also means very stupid in the heart.
Is that right? Is that a common?
Well, that's a strong word. Not stupid, but kind of numb.
Out of touch with.
Yes.
Go on then. Talking about wage increases, that's something I would imagine that almost everyone who works for someone listening to this podcast would acknowledge and would sort of be able to relate to. If you're sitting around and you realize you want a wage increase, say this is one of your wants, say you should you just go and ask for this wage increase? Is that the kind of natural how would you advise someone if top of their list was I'm feeling undervalued at work, and I would like to be valued more? What would your response as a kind of trainer be?
Well, the first thing is to explore what's behind that want, because sometimes it's about like the mere material things that they want to be able to afford. Sometimes it's about the status or acknowledgement or stuff like this. Or maybe someone who you consider doing the same job and earning more, and you know that. And then it's more about fairness. So depending on the needs, that there might be different strategies. And just like what's important in coaching, but in general, like whenever we think about our goals, just not to grab the first very thing and act on it, but think about like what's important. But then it becomes about like what needs to happen in order for you to get this, if we are deciding to that's the goal. More often than not, it's about the conversation. It's about the sales process. How can I either highlight the value that I'm creating, or how can I find out how I can create more value? And in order to do that, we need to be in conversation, because value is subjective, of course, we know that. So we need to understand what is subjectively important for this person who is making decision about the size of your salary.
And if you realize that person's an idiot, then your duty is to leave that place or something? Is that, is that part of the advice process?
Do you mean as an idiot who ignores the value that you're creating?
Yes. The person that doesn't, you don't respect their value. You don't respect their notions of value. And obviously it depends whether who's the idiot, you or them. Yeah, but let's just for the sake of argument, let's say that the person who's giving the job is the guy that's
the idiot. I wouldn't probably frame it as being an idiot.
Well, let's say
there's a value mismatch.
Yes, that's better.
And it depends. Right, there's context. If you have a mortgage, maybe you need to start doing certain things in parallel to search for the job first, or create a project that will provide you something. It also related to complexity. I don't believe in linear things like a job, then next job, then next job. I think we are in a complexity of simultaneous jobs, and like we can have a hobby that's going to be paying our bills in 10 years. So maybe we can just put more awareness on the things that we're already doing, because we are not in a single job. We're not, it's not possible to be in a singular job, like a blob of thing, and I just need to go from one blob of thing to another blob of thing. It's like a very different things. So like I don't give answers to people when I work with them. I help them explore and think about the opportunities. But I'm a strong believer in authentic way to live. So if your job feels like a prison for different reasons, then of course it makes sense to find a better way to use your life, to use your precious and only life.
Authentic living. Have you yourself, have you cracked the code? Like, would you, when you look at
I
your
can
own,
tell my story.
When you when you look at your own life,
yeah.
Do you feel that you've cracked the code? That the thing you're trying to tell everyone, do you go? Yeah, I can give good advice here because I'm living authentically. I'm free. I'm all these things.
Well, I think my life is didn't follow the trajectory it could have followed, because I was born in the middle of Ukraine in a small town, kind of what was back then middle class in Soviet Ukraine. So I think I did certain things to move my strategy in a more aware fashion. But also, like, related to this thing, like we talked about reactivity. And more often than not, I'm not sure if you swear, but like sometimes people leave the job with this fuck you feeling. And when you leave a job like this, my experience or my belief, it's not the truth, but it's my belief that it's going to be hard to find your dream job when you left something with this kind of energy. So my approach is to find a way, how can I reconcile with it? How can I say goodbye it? In an empowered way before I switch to something next. How can I acknowledge this idiot as a person who was probably hurt and traumatized in their life? How can I see their pain before I say them, fuck you?
But what about when you're... I mean, I've had this experience relatively recently. When you're leaving one life behind, like for the last sort of, I suppose, 3 or 4 years, I've been straddling two very distinct worlds in my career. Mm-hmm. I have a former career as a journalist and media personalities, you know, doing all kinds of things in the media.
Yeah.
And then there's this kind of other life that I live, which is this podcast, the Free Cities movement, Bitcoin movement, all these things. And I've straddled both for a number of years. And I definitely now have, you know, especially in the last year, it's become blatantly obvious to me that I want to reside in this world 100% now. And it's very difficult to leave a 20-plus year career behind. And ironically, I mean, you could always say that I haven't actually, because I'm still creating it. We're doing a podcast here. It's like, we're just talking about something else. But this is markedly different to me, to my former life, because the people I worked with didn't think like we do. The gender was completely different. The goals, you know. but so I wouldn't necessarily say I'm saying fuck you to my former life, because I appreciate it. It's just not for me now, you know. Is that okay as well to sort of like let go of something like that? I must admit, though, it's difficult to let go of, but not because it is because I'm struggling to let go of it as well. But it's also because other people won't let go of it. For example, I'll give you an example. How would you deal with this? So say you have a 20-year career in the media and you did really well, and then you want to do something else. And I just want to work with freedom lovers or Bitcoiners. I just want to work with those people. That's all. And I'll do anything. I'll do a sales job. I don't care. I like those people that much. But when you try and do that, people would say, oh, well, can you make a film for us? Or can you do this for us? And you're like, you don't understand. I don't want to make films anymore. I want to just, you know, it's the filmmaking process that I found I don't enjoy anymore. I love this. I mean, what talking is my absolute passion now. I love it. I can't. It's taken me 20 years to realize that this is the best way to operate in the world. But unfortunately, it's not something that you'll get paid a lot of money for. That's not strictly true. I could, I suppose, eventually, but. Yeah. So how would you deal with that?
That's a great question. And in a coaching session, we would explore, but I can answer it.
Well, we can explore. I've got no secrets, man.
I frame this thing as a calling, and sometimes we do not like the calling, and often we reject the calling. And it's very kind of a... there's this typical myth where hero hears the calling and first... He rejects, yes, but it comes again and again. So I think sometimes in our lives happen the things which we know that we need to do, that it's our job to do, but we don't like it. And I think that that's pretty normal. Kind of our minds don't like it, or some of our contractions don't like it. We think maybe we are not too good enough for this kind of job. That's a bit big challenge or something like this. in my experience, I had this situation because, like, here in Prague, my wife and I, we opened a bistro, and we didn't have any experience with food.
A bistro?
Yes.
Whatsoever. Like a restaurant?
Yes. And that was a calling. Like, shit, happened. I need to do it.
You wanted to open a restaurant?
I didn't want to, but it was like, I have to.
Wow. I mean, I don't understand that feeling. I mean, I understand the feeling of I have to, but it's never been connected with I don't want to.
Mm.
It's always...
maybe not I don't want to, but like, who am I to do that?
Oh, okay. Imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome with some other spices.
Stuff. Sprinkled on top.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So I think it's possible to frame it like this.
I don't know. I feel like in my case, I don't feel like an imposter. I suppose I think it's something I don't even think of. I'm relatively confident.
Mm.
And the life I've lived for 20 years, the last 20 years, my career, has put me through so many different things. I've learned so many skills, normal interpersonal skills, like directing something, managing something, producing something, creating something, all those things. They're all part of the, you know, when you run your own business, you have to do that. And so I don't necessarily think I'm I mean, there are obviously, I acknowledge there are some jobs that I don't have the experience for. If you said, right, we need a finance guy, you know, CFO or CTO, whatever, you know, it's like, no, I can't do that. I don't know the start of, you know, I need 10 years experience of being one of those to know what the process you go through. But most other things I'm pretty sure I could do. The problem I have is that because I was relatively well known in my previous life, most people want to employ me as that. So even in this world, in the world of Free Sitters, I've made a few films. I've made some films, you know, and I kind of didn't really want to make the films. I'd love to be in negotiations, you know, like in the Free Cities movement, for example.
Yeah.
A large part of the, you know, if you've got a project and you're trying to basically get a government on board, you need people to go in there and negotiate and to so get the message across, then get an answer out of them. That's the stuff I love. I would love to do that. But because you do that in your job all the time as when you run your own business. But it's not anything I can label a job title to necessarily, but I love it in the same way that I enjoy conversations like this. I love working out what someone is, working out who they are, say, or what they want, and then helping us to sort of discover it together, you know. But I don't know what that job's called. Apart from in podcasting, it's obviously part of that job. But I don't know.
Did you ever say no to... When someone asks you to make a film?
No. I'll tell you why, though. It's in the case of recently, it's come down to I've got a large family and a lot of responsibilities. And when you let go of one thing, you have to, I personally at least, have to fill that gap, that financial gap, with something else.
Yeah.
So if it's not being filled, then you have to have to fill it. That becomes a necessity. And it's annoying in a way because we were talking earlier about going with the flow. And that's been my modus operandi for most of my life. But it has to change when you have a family. When I was in my 20s and 30s as a single guy, I literally just flowed down the river and I had the best time, so many opportunities. You know, it was amazing. Now it's like... I'm rowing down the river and I've got my family in the boat with me. So I can't just say, let's just go with the flow, because I'm bringing like five people along with me.
Yeah.
And it's different, actually. Yeah. It's a new kind of experience. Yeah.
And the distinction could be between I cannot and I don't want to. And it could be that you make the same decision, but with a different energy. Like, I know why I'm doing this.
Because in the case of what?
Accepting the film job.
Okay.
Or the film project. Is that it seems
But what if I don't, to butt in, but what if I don't even want it? What if I'm really trying? You don't even have to use me as an example. choose somebody in their early 50s who wants a career change, mm-hmm. but they've spent 20 years in a very well-defined role. Like as a, I mean, I was a photographer, photojournalist, filmmaker, producer, director, and then all of those things together, yeah. you know, they all come under the umbrella these days of kind of media, I suppose. But if you don't want to do that, how do you rediscover mm-hmm. something? How do you move sideways? Yeah. Not down, and then, because you can't mm-hmm. move down when you've got a large family.
That's usually kind of this frame of moving sideways is very difficult, because then it seems like impossible. Because when I think that I was this thing A and now I need to become this thing B, it seems like impossible. Like if I spend 30 years to achieve this success here, it means that I need to spend 30 more years to achieve success there. But if we split this A or this job into, like you said, you have many different skills. And then when you can start reinventing yourself, and I'm guessing that's what you're doing right now. You do different things. So you're kind of in a, how do you call it, transitionary space, liminal space, where basically you are in between things. And it's basically how can you learn from the stories that you already have? Because in many cases, life already taught us a lot of things. It's not like we're coming as a blank slate to a new job or a new career. It's like, how can we move those things? And of course, it's more useful to start thinking about this thing earlier and think like, how can I diversify right now? How can I develop different selves or different identities that I have? Because it's often also like we are clinging to the certain identity that I have, or maybe like material status that was important for that identity. And maybe it's not important that much anymore, but we still cling to it. So it's more like, how can I, losing those things and consider possibilities? Because like, it's not that I have like prescription what to do, but more often than not, if we are willing to play, to experiment, we can discover things. It's possible.
In my case, and you'll appreciate this probably, I got to the point three months ago now, where I forced my hand. So I had one particular part of my business which earned quite a lot of money that I did every year. it was very easy to do, and it generated a lot of income. And I stopped it. Mm. I stopped it in September, which means I have until about January, February's amount of money left. Uh-huh. Before the shit's the fan. So, and what's happened which is very interesting, because I've never done that before. And I did it for a number of reasons, but one of them was this obviously intuition that I need to force my hand here, because I've got this comfort zone that is very hard to leave. And if I force myself to do it, then almost certainly something will change. And as a result, it's true, right? Because it's forcing me to do things that I don't feel comfortable doing. Like, for example, just even like I've applied for a job, you know, like I've never had a job my whole life that I've had to apply for. Early on in my career, I had to sort of sell myself to a picture editor or something. But you just basically go and see them and show them your photos and they go, wow, these are good. But then beyond that, you never have to sell. You don't have to sell yourself. I never used to. My jobs just used to come. So I started filling in actual job applications for things that probably weren't that suitable for me. But I would never normally do that. Mm. And it was a very uncomfortable thing to do, because the part of me that you probably already acknowledged would be that, well, I shouldn't need to do this. You know, I shouldn't be applying for jobs. I should be. And I mean, the truth is, one of the things that I grapple with is that, yes, I should be creating a new company. I shouldn't be applying to work for someone else. Yeah. But I feel like that I don't know what to create. So the secondary thought is then, okay, well, see what's out there and say, find someone doing something that you'd really like and then offer yourself to them. And that's what I've started doing. So it has worked in that sense. And it's not that I've even got results from it. But what it has done is taken me down some really interesting pathways to discover things that I wouldn't have discovered before. And But I'm no nearer, as it seems, I don't think I'm any nearer to getting what I want. Because I'm not, I think like what you said earlier, I'm not 100% sure I know what I want. You know, like if you, like I'll give you an example. When you said, imagine the thing you definitely want, right? So forget all the you can and can't or responsibility. What would you do? Do you know what I would want? I would want this podcast to earn £100,000 a year, be happy with that, and just do this forever. Because I love talking to people on podcasts, right? So give me enough money to employ someone to help, to travel around the world and do it. That would literally, no holds barred, be what I would want. Very difficult thing to get, I'm sure. But that is actually what I would want. Now, because I know how difficult that is to achieve, because even the, you know, the content that we talk about, is a certainly, it's kind of a limited market compared to a lot of podcasts, because it's of quite a specific, you know, interest. So I know it's going to be very difficult to generate large sums of money to make it viable. So as a result, then I think, okay, that's not possible. So what should I do instead? So am I making a mistake there? Should I just hold that absolute dream in my mind and go for it, or should I be realistic about it?
Yeah. So your question is, I can give you an idea what may happen or what may work is that it's not like either or. You hold it and you do whatever else is needs to be done.
Sorry, say that again. You.
So basically, it's not like okay, it's possible or impossible. So
just, it is possible. It's very difficult. I don't know many people. I mean, I just said 100,000 because that's a nice number.
Yes.
But that would mean getting sponsors or getting someone to pay. You know, like it's definitely doable. Yeah. But I'm not sure it's doable in this particular sort of group of, you know, the kind of things we talk about, because it's not a broad
so
subject.
In a field of complexity, you work with complexity, and life is complex, that there's no clear answer. You work by doing small, safe experiments. So what can be an experiment that can help you learn more about possibility of that?
In the case of this podcast, would that be, for example, approaching someone, a potential sponsor? I mean, we don't need a sponsor in a way, because the foundation funds this podcast. But actually, if we wanted to expand, yeah, it'd be lovely to get a sponsor, because then there'd be more money to spend on the whole thing. Yes. You know? Is that the kind of thing you mean, like to take little, make little tests?
Yes. Yeah. Or like at least start, put some energy there, like your mental energy, but also like physical. Start doing something about it. Usually it helps you learn. Maybe you will not get precisely this thing, but you will get something out of it. Like you mentioned, it was a metaphor about the sword in the lake.
Yes.
But like selling your apartment, it was non-linear solution to your problem. But like this thing led to unpredictable consequences because it was not holding you anymore. And sometimes like it's like this in business and in life. You do something thing that leads to unpredictable things. And of course, it's good to think about second order consequences, third order consequences, but life is too complicated. We will not learn about all the possibilities. But starting doing something, or at least not to dismiss your passionate goal only because it's not clear what to do about it. I mean, I compare this type of thinking to the way like creativity works or like scientific discoveries. It's a discovery modality of thinking. It's not the rational thing, like you create a plan, just brute force, as I said, brute force with your brain and you will have the solution. But what happens with discovery? Sometimes you need to spend a year before the this idea or this insight comes in and suddenly you know the answer. But if you let go of this intention, then your creative mind will not work on it. Maybe kind of it's not going to be your topmost priority, but like review this idea from, I don't know, every week or every month and think like, is there a small step that I can take toward it?
Well, I mean, even talking to you now, I'd never actually contemplated that it could be a reality. But I've often thought of it. And the way I would do that would be I would notice, say, someone who runs a podcast who is achieving what I would like to achieve, and just thinking, oh, look, that's cool, someone's doing it. But I actually would never turn that around and say, why don't you aim for that? It's interesting.
Because our minds tend to dismiss those things very quickly.
Hmm.
And that's kind of the power of holding the space for these conversations. Whenever certain things that kind of you can not necessarily draw for people, but just like helping them notice, oh, you see that was this thing, and you kind of dismissed it too quickly. Do you want to hold onto it for a bit longer? Because like these things, they're happening in our minds so quickly, we're just not capable of noticing everything. I need a coach because like I have my own stuff to work with. So we just need someone to be with us and help us hold everything, and kind of whenever we speak aloud is a different thing. Like in one good coaching book, there was a quote something to the effect of the quality of person's thinking depends on the quality of attention of the person who's with them.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, I did some listening skills, and you know, you just put two people and face to face and tell them to tell the story. And they tell the story normally, but then kind of you turn them around so they sit back to back and do the same thing. Then it becomes much harder to tell the story because you don't have an observer.
Well, that's, I fully understand that. Because that's why I've insisted on this podcast. I'd always do in-person interviews. We've never done a non-in-person interview.
Uh-huh.
And it's many times it's been a real ball ache and expensive, but the experience that we're having now is unmatched in any other way.
Mm.
Even if, you know, I say I employed you as a coach and we did it over Zoom, it would still be different. And I'm really on board with that. I hope that I can keep that up. I mean, 102 episodes we've done in person so far. It's not, I don't think many podcasts do.
Yeah.
Because it's not financially viable. That's basically it.
Yeah.
Unless you are one of the big ones where they bring in literally hundreds of thousands of dollars per, you know.
Yeah. That's a popular essay in startup spaces. Do things that do not scale. At least at first. Because sometimes people tend to think about scaling too early and they start to do things that only will scale.
I don't think I'm that guy. I don't think about scaling. I think about my whole career has been like that. Like, and then one of the other ways I can sort of relate to that is when you first become a photographer, there's this imposter syndrome that many people get. Because it's very hard to pinpoint the moment when you aren't a photographer and you are a photographer. And I think a lot of people, the way they deal with that is when they decide to be a photographer, they go straight out and they spend $30,000 on all the equipment. And that, I think, and I didn't do that. Like my first job as a photographer, I worked in newspapers. I was on Fleet Street. And I did my first 6 months of work with a camera that I bought, you know, almost as a child, as a teenager, I bought this camera. And the first real camera I bought from my wages from 6 months of work or whatever. But I think that's how I think. And I was probably thinking the same way with this podcast. I don't know if it's necessarily good or bad, but
yeah. And it's interesting because like a lot of time people need some kind of permission. And socially, the way we get this permission is through credentials. You go and finish a degree.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is also, it doesn't really make you a professional, but kind of it's an external confirmation. And I think it would be much easier if we just go away with that because we don't need them. It's just...
No, I agree 100%. I think...
just an illusion.
Well, there may be some arenas in which it is useful, like certain places you need a training, for example. I mean, there are plenty of jobs where you actually need to be trained.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like it's not that you can just go and work it out on the job. But
it could be. I mean, a lot of people who come from Ukraine to the Czech Republic, like dentists, they are fully proficient people already, but they need just the paper because...
Oh, okay. Yeah. But what I mean is, how did they study dentistry in Ukraine?
Yeah, of course. Of course they...
Exactly. They had their own sort of... They were given the green light in Ukraine. Yeah. It's just here it's a different version.
But I also think that market will sort it out, like the reputation and all that. So it's...
I hate to cut this thing short because I'm really would love to carry on, but on account that you filled in at the very last minute, I know that in 10 minutes time I've got somebody else coming to the studio and we're going to have to record, so I'm going to have to try and round it up. But maybe this is a very, you don't have to answer this question, but can you tell me something about me that you think I don't know? Something that I'm missing, like, just, I know we've only spoken for an hour and a half, but is there something that you think that, like, because I'm always trying to better myself, I'm always trying to understand myself better, to operate better, but you probably noticed some things about me that I've never noticed. I don't know, maybe you have, maybe you haven't.
Well, first of all, I think that you have access to much more clarity that you realize. It's just like, you know, this cluttering brain that may distract from it. Why I'm saying this, it feels like you are making actions which empower you to take the steps that you need to take. And probably like something in your head then doubt them, kind of in hindsight. So I think you have more clarity that you may realize.
Yeah, I could agree with that, probably. I certainly feel I have clarity. I suppose sometimes I don't know what to be clear about. That would be the thing, you know.
Then it's a question, what you do then?
Yes.
Or what you don't do then? Maybe you don't rush to the next thing and hold this space of uncertainty for a longer period.
Well, I'm doing that. It's not necessarily my own decision, but I agree. Like holding a space of uncertainties, it seems like a great idea, right? But what about the fact that you have financial, responsibilities? That means you can't hold that space for too long. What do you do in those situations?
Well, if you mean in terms of like, should I take a job? Probably yes.
No. But should I? What if the whole thing was a terrible mistake? And, it can't ever be a terrible mistake. There's all, I'll always find a way. I know the answer to my own question here, I'll find a way. I'm certain of that. It's just, I think what my takeaway from this conversation and will be, and you said it right at the start, is first you need to know what you want before you can actually then get it. And some people may struggle in getting it. I think probably I struggle in not getting it, but in finding out what it is that I want.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And as a temporary project, what could happen then is like, okay, I don't know, and then what I want is to find what I want. So that's kind of like a first step.
Happened in me. Happened since this conversation started. Yes. No, this will be my because I do tend to, you know, meditate on things a lot. And I will be meditating on what actually do you want? And, you know, like I say, probably it would be to scale this, what we're doing now, to scale this somehow. And I think I'm getting training in how to do things uncomfortably because I've literally forced my hand. And I should imagine those two things together will probably work quite well to actually make that reality manifest, I suppose.
I think that like you're a creative person because you come from creative profession, but also like I'm guessing that images and metaphors work for you well. So maybe observing these things, like I think of it, you know, like a cramps that you can follow. So just observe what resonates, what symbols, what these kind of things.
Hmm. Well, one of those happened this morning because my previous guest dropped out because his flight was cancelled. And while I was walking around, twiddling my fingers, thinking I'm wasting 3 hours here, I realized before you actually contacted me, I thought to myself, there's probably a reason why this happened. And at the time, I thought it was because I applied for a job earlier, just randomly, because I thought I've got some spare time. So I did, but actually it was probably because I got to speak to you, which I'm very thankful for. Mm. So thanks for coming in. And
My pleasure.
I hope it'd be good to have another conversation at some point, but I'm sorry I have to cut it off now, but
no worries.
My hand is being forced. But Alex, thanks for...
it was a great conversation.
Thanks for your time. Good luck. Good luck. You might even come for a consultation myself, although it looks like I just got one for free.
We do slightly different stuff, but...
Okay, great. It was great talking to you anyway.
Yeah, thanks. From me as well.